I don't hurt anyone but myself. I can't go through that again, I warn him. I know. I'll talk to them, says Cinna. Lunch makes me feel a bit better. Pheasant, with a selection of jewel-colored jellies and tiny versions of real vegetables swimming in butter, and potatoes mashed with parsley. For dessert, we dip chunks of fruit in a pot of melted chocolate, and Cinna has to order a second pot because I start just eating the stuff with a spoon. So, what are we wearing for the opening ceremonies? I finally ask as I scrape the second pot clean. Headlamps or fire? I know the chariot ride will require Peeta and me to be dressed in something coal-related. Something along that line, he says. When it's time to get in costume for the opening ceremonies, my prep team shows up, but Cinna sends them away, saying they've done such a spectacular job in the morning, there's nothing left to do. They go off to recover, thankfully leaving me in Cinna's hands. He puts up my hair first, in the braided style my mother introduced him to, then proceeds with my makeup. Last year he used little so that the audience would recognize me when I landed in the arena. But now my face is almost obscured by the dramatic highlights and dark shadows. High arching eyebrows, sharp cheekbones, smoldering eyes, deep purple lips. The costume looks deceptively simple at first, just a fitted black jumpsuit that covers me from the neck down. He places a half crown, like the one I received as victor, on my head, but it's made of a heavy black metal, not gold. Then he adjusts the light in the room to mimic twilight and presses a button just inside the fabric on my wrist. I look down, fascinated, as my ensemble slowly comes to life. First with a soft golden light, but gradually transforming to the orange-red of burning coal. I look as if I have been coated in glowing embers. No, that I am a glowing ember straight from our fireplace. The colors rise and fall, shift and blend, in exactly the way the coals do. How did you do this? I say in wonder. Portia and I spent a lot of hours watching fires, says Cinna. Now, look at yourself. He turns me toward a mirror so that I can take in the entire effect. I do not see a girl, or even a woman, but some unearthly being who looks like she might make her home in the volcano that destroyed so many in Haymitch's Quell. The black crown, which now appears red-hot, casts strange shadows on my dramatically made-up face. Katniss, the girl on fire, has left behind her flickering flames and bejeweled gowns and soft candlelight frocks. She is as deadly as fire itself. I think this is just what I needed to face the others, I say. Yes, I think your days of pink lipstick and ribbons are behind you, says Cinna. He touches the button on my wrist again, extinguishing my light. Let's not run down your power pack. When you're on the chariot this time, no waving, no smiling. I just want you to look straight ahead as if the entire audience is beneath your notice. Finally, something I'll be good at, I say. Cinna has a few more things to attend to, so I decide to head down to the ground floor of the Remake Center, which houses the huge gathering place for the tributes and their chariots before the opening ceremonies. I'm hoping to find Peeta and Haymitch, but they haven't arrived yet. Unlike last year, when all the tributes were practically glued to their chariots, the scene is very social. The victors, both this year's tributes and their mentors, are standing around in small groups, talking. Of course, they all know one another, and I don't know anyone, and I'm not really the sort of person to go around introducing myself. So I just stroke the neck of one of my horses and try not to be noticed. It doesn't work. The crunching hits my ear before I even know he's beside me, and when I turn my head, Finnick O'Dare's famous sea green eyes are only inches from mine. He pops a sugar cube in his mouth and leans against my horse. "Hello, Katniss," he says, as if we've known each other for years, when in fact we've never met. "Hello, Finnick," I say, just as casually, although I'm feeling uncomfortable at his closeness, especially since he's got so much bare skin exposed.
"Want a sugar cube?"
he says, offering his hand, which is piled high.
"They're supposed to be for the horses, but who cares? They've got years to eat sugar, whereas you and I, well, if we see something sweet, we better grab it quick."
Finnick O'Dare is something of a living legend in Panem. Since he won the 65th Hunger Games when he was only 14, he's still one of the youngest victors. Being from District 4, he was a career, so the odds were already in his favor. But what no trainer could claim to have given him was his extraordinary beauty. Tall, athletic, with golden skin and bronze-colored hair, and those incredible eyes. While other tributes that year were hard-pressed to get a handful of grain or some matches for a gift, Finnick never wanted for anything, not food or medicine or weapons. It took about a week for his competitors to realize that he was the one to kill, but it was too late. He was already a good fighter with the spears and knives he had found in the cornucopia. When he received a silver parachute with a trident, which may be the most expensive gift I've ever seen given in the arena, it was all over. District 4's industry is fishing. He'd been on boats his whole life. The trident was a natural, deadly extension of his arm. He wove a net out of some kind of vine he found, used it to entangle his opponents so he could spear them with the trident, and within a matter of days the crown was his. The citizens of the capital have been drooling over him ever since. Because of his youth, they couldn't really touch him for the first year or two, but ever since he turned 16, he's spent his time at the games being dogged by those desperately in love with him. No one retains his favor for long. He can go through 4 or 5 in his annual visit. Old or young, lovely or plain, rich or very rich, he'll keep them company and take their extravagant gifts, but he never stays, and once he's gone, he never comes back. I can't argue that Finnick isn't one of the most stunning, sensuous people on the planet, but I can honestly say he's never been attractive to me. Maybe he's too pretty, or maybe he's too easy to get, or maybe it's really that he'd just be too easy to lose. "No thanks," I say to the sugar. "I'd love to borrow your outfit sometime, though." He's draped in a golden net that's strategically knotted at his groin so that he can't technically be called naked, but he's about as close as you can get. I'm sure his stylist thinks the more of Finnick the audience sees, the better.
"You're absolutely terrifying me in that getup. What happened to the pretty little girl dresses?" he asks.
He wets his lips just ever so slightly with his tongue. Probably this drives most people crazy, but for some reason all I can think of is old Cray salivating over some poor starving young woman. "I outgrew them," I say. Finnick takes the collar of my outfit and runs it between his fingers.
"It's too bad about this Quell thing. You could have made out like a bandit in the capital. Jewels, money, anything you wanted."
"I don't like jewels, and I have more money than I need." "What do you spend all yours on anyway, Finnick?" I say.
"Oh, I haven't dealt in anything as common as money for years," says Finnick.
"Then how do they pay you for the pleasure of your company?" I ask.
"With secrets," he says softly.
He tips his head in so his lips are almost in contact with mine.
"What about you, girl on fire? Do you have any secrets worth my time?"
For some stupid reason, I blush, but I force myself to hold my ground. No, I'm an open book, I whisper back. Everybody seems to know my secrets before I know them myself.
He smiles. Unfortunately, I think that's true. His eyes flicker off to the side. Peter is coming. Sorry you have to cancel your wedding. I know how devastating that must be for you.
He tosses another sugar cube in his mouth and saunters off. Peter's beside me, dressed in an outfit identical to mine.
What did Finnick O'Dare want? He asks.
I turn and put my lips close to Peter's and drop my eyelids in imitation of Finnick. He offered me sugar and wanted to know all my secrets, I say in my best seductive voice.
Peter laughs. Ugh! Not really.
Really, I say. I'll tell you more when my skin stops crawling.
Do you think we'd have ended up like this if only one of us had won? He asks, glancing around at the other victors. Just another part of the freak show?
Sure, especially you, I say.
Oh, and why especially me? He says with a smile.
Because you have a weakness for beautiful things and I don't, I say with an air of superiority. They would lure you into their capital ways, and you'd be lost entirely.
Having an eye for beauty isn't the same thing as a weakness, Peter points out, except possibly when it comes to you. The music is beginning, and I see the wide doors opening for the first chariot, hear the roar of the crowd. Shall we? He holds out a hand to help me into the chariot.
I climb up and pull him up after me. Hold still, I say, and straighten his crown. Have you seen your suit turned on? We're going to be fabulous again.
Absolutely, but Portia says we're to be very above it all. No waving or anything, he says. Where are they, anyway?
I don't know. I eye the procession of chariots. Maybe we better go ahead and switch ourselves on. We do, and as we begin to glow, I can see people pointing at us and chattering, and I know that, once again, we'll be the talk of the opening ceremonies. We're almost at the door. I crane my head around, but neither Portia nor Cinna, who were with us right up to the final second last year, are anywhere in sight. Are we supposed to hold hands this year? I ask.
I guess they've left it up to us, says Peter.
I look up into those blue eyes that no amount of dramatic makeup can make truly deadly, and remember how, just a year ago, I was prepared to kill him, convinced he was trying to kill me. Now everything is reversed. I'm determined to keep him alive, knowing the cost will be my own life. But the part of me that is not so brave as I could wish is glad that it's Peter, not Haymitch, beside me. Our hands find each other without further discussion. Of course, we will go into this as one. The voice of the crowd rises into one universal scream as we roll into the fading evening light, but neither one of us reacts. I simply fix my eyes on a point far in the distance and pretend there is no audience, no hysteria. I can't help catching glimpses of us on the huge screens along the route, and we are not just beautiful, we are dark and powerful. No more, we star-crossed lovers from District 12, who suffered so much and enjoyed so little the rewards of our victory, do not seek the fans' favor, grace them with our smiles, or catch their kisses. We are unforgiving. And I love it. Getting to be myself at last. As we curve around into the loop of the city circle, I can see that a couple of other stylists have tried to steal Cinna and Portia's idea of illuminating their tributes. The electric light-studded outfits from District 3, where they make electronics, at least make sense. But what are the livestock keepers from District 10, who are dressed as cows, doing with flaming belts? Broiling themselves? Pathetic. Peter and I, on the other hand, are so mesmerizing with our ever-changing coal costume that most of the other tributes are staring at us. We seem particularly riveting to the pair from District 6, who are known morphling addicts, both bone-thin, with sagging yellowish skin. They can't tear their overlarge eyes away, even when President Snow begins to speak from his balcony, welcoming us all to the Quell. The anthem plays, and as we make our final trip around the circle, am I wrong? Or do I see the president fixated on me as well? Peter and I wait until the doors of the training center have closed behind us to relax. Cinna and Portia are there, pleased with our performance, and Haymitch has made an appearance this year as well, only he's not at our chariot. He's over with the tributes of District 11. I see him nod in our direction, and then they follow him over to greet us. I know Chaff by sight because I've spent years watching him pass a bottle back and forth with Haymitch on television. He's dark-skinned, about 6 feet tall, and one of his arms ends in a stump because he lost his hand in the games he won 30 years ago. I'm sure they offered him some artificial replacement, like they did Peter when they had to amputate his lower leg, but I guess he didn't take it. The woman, Cedar, looks almost like she could be from the seam, with her olive skin and straight black hair streaked with silver. Only her golden brown eyes mark her as from another district. She must be around 60, but she still looks strong, and there's no sign she's turned to liquor or morphling or any other chemical form of escape over the years. Before either of us says a word, she embraces me. I know somehow it must be because of Rue and Thresh. Before I can stop myself, I whisper, "The families? They're alive," she says back softly before letting me go. Chaff throws his good arm around me and gives me a big kiss right on the mouth. I jerk back, startled, while he and Haymitch guffaw. That's about all the time we get before the Capitol attendants are firmly directing us toward the elevators. I get the distinct feeling they're not comfortable with the camaraderie among the victors, who couldn't seem to care less. As I walk toward the elevators, my hand still linked with Peeta's, someone else rustles up to my side. The girl pulls off a headdress of leafy branches and tosses it behind her without bothering to look where it falls. Joanna Mason, from District 7, Lumber and Paper, thus the tree. She won by very convincingly portraying herself as weak and helpless so that she would be ignored. Then she demonstrated a wicked ability to murder. She ruffles up her spiky hair and rolls her wide-set brown eyes. "Isn't my costume awful? My stylist's the biggest idiot in the Capitol. Our tributes have been trees for 40 years under her. Wish I'd gotten Cinna. You look fantastic." Girl talk. That thing I've always been so bad at. Opinions on clothes, hair, makeup. So I lie. "Yeah, he's been helping me design my own clothing line. You should see what he can do with velvet." Velvet? The only fabric I could think of off the top of my head. "I have. On your tour, that strapless number you wore in District 2, the deep blue one with the diamonds, so gorgeous I wanted to reach through the screen and tear it right off your back," says Joanna. "I bet you did," I think, "with a few inches of my flesh." While we wait for the elevators, Joanna unzips the rest of her tree, letting it drop to the floor, and then kicks it away in disgust. Except for her forest green slippers, she doesn't have a stitch of clothing. That's better. We end up on the same elevator with her, and she spends the whole ride to the 7th floor chatting to Peter about his paintings while the light of his still glowing costume reflects off her bare breasts. When she leaves, I ignore him, but I just know he's grinning. I toss aside his hand as the doors close behind Chaff and Cedar, leaving us alone, and he breaks out laughing. "What?" I say, turning on him as we step out on our floor. "It's you, Katniss. can't you see? He says. What's me? I say. Why they're all acting like this? Finnick with his sugar cubes and Chaff kissing you and that whole thing with Joanna stripping down? He tries to take a more serious tone, unsuccessfully. They're playing with you because you're so... you know. No, I don't know, I say, and I really have no idea what he's talking about. It's like when you wouldn't look at me naked in the arena, even though I was half dead. You're so... pure, he says finally. I am not, I say. I've been practically ripping your clothes off every time there's been a camera for the last year. Yeah, but I mean, for the Capitol, you're pure, he says, clearly trying to mollify me. For me, you're perfect. They're just teasing you. No, they're laughing at me, and so are you, I say. No, Peter shakes his head, but he's still suppressing a smile. I'm seriously rethinking the question of who should get out of these games alive when the other elevator opens. Haymitch and Effie join us, looking pleased about something. Then Haymitch's face grows hard. What should I do now? I almost say, but I see he's staring behind me at the entrance to the dining room. Effie blinks in the same direction, then says brightly, Looks like they've got you a matched set this year. I turn around and find the red-headed Avox girl who tended to me last year until the games began. I think how nice it is to have a friend here. I notice that the young man beside her, another Avox, also has red hair. That must be what Effie meant by a matched set. Then a chill runs through me, because I know him, too. Not from the Capitol, but from years of having easy conversations at the Hob, joking over Greasy Say's soup, and that last day, watching him lie unconscious in the square while the life bled out of Gale. Our new Avox is Darius. Chapter 16. Haymitch grips my wrist as if anticipating my next move, but I am as speechless as the Capitol's torturers have rendered Darius. Haymitch once told me they did something to Avox's tongues so they could never talk again. In my head, I hear Darius's voice, playful and bright, ringing across the Hob to tease me. Not as my fellow victors make fun of me now, but because we genuinely liked each other. If Gale could see him... I know any move I would make toward Darius, any act of recognition, would only result in punishment for him, so we just stare into each other's eyes. Darius, now a mute slave, me, now headed to death. What would we say, anyway? That we're sorry for the other's lot? That we ache for the other's pain? That we're glad we had the chance to know each other? No, Darius shouldn't be glad he knew me. If I had been there to stop Thread, he wouldn't have stepped forward to save Gale, wouldn't be an Avox. And more specifically, wouldn't be my Avox, because President Snow has so obviously had him placed here for my benefit. I twist my wrist from Haymitch's grasp and head down to my old bedroom, locking the door behind me. I sit on the side of my bed, elbows on my knees, forehead on my fists, and watch my glowing suit in the darkness, imagining I am in my old home in District 12, huddled beside the fire. It slowly fades back to black as the power pack dies out. When Effie eventually knocks on the door to summon me to dinner, I get up and take off my suit, fold it neatly, and set it on the table with my crown. In the bathroom, I wash the dark streaks of makeup from my face. I dress in a simple shirt and pants and go down the hall to the dining room. I'm not aware of much at dinner except that Darius and the red-headed Avox girl are our servers. Effie, Hamish, Cinna, Portia, and Peeta are all there, talking about the opening ceremonies, I suppose. But the only time I really feel present is when I purposely knock a dish of peas on the floor, and before anyone can stop me, crouch down to clean them up. Darius is right by me when I send the dish over, and we two are briefly side by side, obscured from view as we scoop up the peas. For just one moment our hands meet. I can feel his skin, rough under the buttery sauce from the dish. In the tight, desperate clench of our fingers are all the words we will never be able to say. Then Effie's clucking at me from behind about how that's not your job, Katniss, and he lets go. When we go in to watch the recap of the opening ceremonies, I wedge myself in between Cinna and Haymitch on the couch because I don't want to be next to Peeta. This awfulness with Darius belongs to me and Gale, and maybe even Haymitch, but not to Peeta. He might have known Darius to nod hello, but Peeta wasn't Hob the way the rest of us were. Besides, I'm still angry with him for laughing at me along with the other victors, and the last thing I want is his sympathy and comfort. I haven't changed my mind about saving him in the arena, but I don't owe him more than that. As I watch the procession to the city circle, I think how it's bad enough that they dress us all in costumes and parade us through the streets in chariots on a regular year. Kids in costumes are silly, but aging victors, it turns out, are pitiful. A few who are on the younger side, like Joanna and Finnick, or whose bodies haven't fallen into disrepair, like Cedar and Brutus, can still manage to maintain a little dignity. But the majority, who are in the clutches of drink, or morphling, or illness, look grotesque in their costumes, depicting cows and trees and loaves of bread. Last year we chattered away about each contestant, but tonight there's only the occasional comment. Small wonder the crowd goes wild when Peeta and I appear, looking so young and strong and beautiful in our brilliant costumes. The very image of what tributes should be. As soon as it's over, I stand up and thank Cinna and Portia for their amazing work and head off to bed. Effie calls a reminder to meet early for breakfast to work out our training strategy, but even her voice sounds hollow. Poor Effie. She finally had a decent year in the games with Peeta and me, and now it's all broken down into a mess that even she can't put a positive spin on. In capital terms, I'm guessing this counts as a true tragedy. Soon after I go to bed, there's a quiet knock on my door, but I ignore it. I don't want Peeta tonight, especially not with Darius around. It's almost as bad as if Gale were here. Gale, how am I supposed to let him go with Darius haunting the hallways? Tongues figure prominently in my nightmares. First, I watch frozen and helpless while gloved hands carry out the bloody dissection in Darius's mouth. Then, I'm at a party where everyone wears masks and someone with a flickering wet tongue, who I suppose is Finnick, stalks me. But when he catches me and pulls off his mask, it's President Snow, and his puffy lips are dripping in bloody saliva. Finally, I'm back in the arena, my own tongue as dry as sandpaper, while I try to reach a pool of water that recedes every time I'm about to touch it. When I wake, I stumble to the bathroom and gulp water from the faucet until I can hold no more. I strip off my sweaty clothes and fall back into bed, naked, and somehow find sleep again. I delay going down to breakfast as long as possible the next morning, because I really don't want to discuss our training strategy. What's to discuss? Every victor already knows what everybody else can do, or used to be able to do anyway. So Peeta and I will continue to act in love, and that's that. Somehow, I'm just not up to talking about it, especially with Darius standing mutely by. I take a long shower, dress slowly in the outfit Cinna has left for training, and order food from the menu in my room by speaking into a mouthpiece. In a minute, sausage, eggs, potatoes, bread, juice, and hot chocolate appear. I eat my fill, trying to drag out the minutes until 10 o'clock, when we have to go down to the training center. By 9:30, Haymitch is pounding on my door, obviously fed up with me, ordering me to the dining room now. Still, I brush my teeth before meandering down the hall, effectively killing another 5 minutes. The dining room's empty, except for Peeta and Haymitch, whose face is flushed with drink and anger. On his wrist he wears a solid gold bangle with a pattern of flames. This must be his concession to Effie's matching token plan, that he twists unhappily. It's a very handsome bangle, really, but the movement makes it seem like something confining, a shackle, rather than a piece of jewelry. "You're late," he snarls at me. "Sorry. I slept in after the mutilated tongue nightmares kept me up half the night." I mean to sound hostile, but my voice catches at the end of the sentence. Haymitch gives me a scowl, then relents.
"All right, never mind. Today, in training, you've got 2 jobs. One, stay in love."
"Obviously," I say.
"And 2, make some friends," says Haymitch.
"No," I say. "I don't trust any of them. I can't stand most of them, and I'd rather operate with just the 2 of us.
"That's what I said at first, but," Peeta begins. "But it won't be enough," Haymitch insists. "You're going to need more allies this time around."
"Why?" I ask.
"Because you're at a distinct disadvantage. Your competitors have known each other for years. So who do you think they're going to target first?" he says.
"Us. And nothing we're going to do is going to override any old friendship," I say. "So why bother?"
"Because you can fight. You're popular with the crowd. That could still make you desirable allies. But only if you let the others know you're willing to team up with them," says Haymitch.
"You mean you want us in the career pack this year?" I ask, unable to hide my distaste. Traditionally, the tributes from District 1, 2, and 4 join forces, possibly taking in a few other exceptional fighters and hunt down the weaker competitors.
"That's been our strategy, hasn't it? To train like careers," counters Haymitch. "And who makes up the career pack is generally agreed upon before the games begin. Peeta barely got in with them last year."
I think of the loathing I felt when I discovered Peeta was with the careers during the last games. "So we're to try to get in with Finnick and Brutus. Is that what you're saying?"
"Not necessarily. Everyone's a victor. Make your own pack if you'd rather. Choose who you like. I'd suggest Chaff and Cedar. Although Finnick's not to be ignored," says Haymitch. "Find someone to team up with who might be of some use to you. Remember, you're not in a ring full of trembling children anymore. These people are all experienced killers, no matter what shape they appear to be in."
Maybe he's right. Only who could I trust? Cedar, maybe. But do I really want to make a pact with her, only to possibly have to kill her later? No. Still, I made a pact with Rue under the same circumstances. I tell Haymitch I'll try, even though I think I'll be pretty bad at the whole thing. Effie shows up a bit early to take us down, because last year, even though we were on time, we were the last 2 tributes to show up. But Haymitch tells her he doesn't want her taking us down to the gym. None of the other victors will be showing up with a babysitter, and being the youngest, it's even more important we look self-reliant. So she has to satisfy herself with taking us to the elevator, fussing over our hair, and pushing the button for us. It's such a short ride that there's no real time for conversation, but when Peeta takes my hand, I don't pull it away. I may have ignored him last night in private, but in training we must appear as an inseparable team. Effie needn't have worried about us being the last to arrive. Only Brutus and the woman from District 2, Enobaria, are present. Enobaria looks to be about 30, and all I can remember about her is that in hand-to-hand combat, she killed one tribute by ripping open his throat with her teeth. She became so famous for this act that after she was a victor, she had her teeth cosmetically altered so each one ends in a sharp point like a fang and is inlaid with gold. She has no shortage of admirers in the capital. By 10 o'clock, only about half of the tributes have shown up. Atala, the woman who runs training, begins her spiel right on time, unfazed by the poor attendance. Maybe she expected it. I'm sort of relieved, because that means there are a dozen people I don't have to pretend to make friends with. Atala runs through the list of stations, which include both combat and survival skills, and releases us to train. I tell Peeta I think we'd do best to split up, thus covering more territory. When he goes off to chuck spears with Brutus and Chaff, I head over to the knot-tying station. Hardly anyone ever bothers to visit it. I like the trainer, and he remembers me fondly, maybe because I spent time with him last year. He's pleased when I show him I can still set the trap that leaves an enemy dangling by a leg from a tree. Clearly he took note of my snares in the arena last year and now sees me as an advanced pupil. So I ask him to review every kind of knot that might come in handy and a few that I'll probably never use. I'd be content to spend the morning alone with him, but after about an hour and a half, someone puts his arm around me from behind, his fingers easily finishing the complicated knot I've been sweating over. Of course, it's Finnick, who seems to have spent his childhood doing nothing but wielding tridents and manipulating ropes into fancy knots for nets, I guess. I watch for a minute while he picks up a length of rope, makes a noose, and then pretends to hang himself for my amusement. Rolling my eyes, I head over to another vacant station where tributes can learn to build fires. I already make excellent fires, but I'm still pretty dependent on matches for starting them. So the trainer has me work with flint, steel, and some charred cloth. This is much harder than it looks, and even working as intently as I can, it takes me about an hour to get a fire going. I look up with a triumphant smile, only to find I have company. The two tributes from District 3 are beside me, struggling to start a decent fire with matches. I think about leaving, but I really want to try using the flint again, and if I have to report back to Haymitch that I tried to make friends, these two might be a bearable choice. Both are small in stature, with ashen skin and black hair. The woman, Wyrus, is probably around my mother's age and speaks in a quiet, intelligent voice. But right away I notice she has a habit of dropping off her words in mid-sentence, as if she's forgotten you're there. Beatty, the man, is older and somewhat fidgety. He wears glasses but spends a lot of time looking under them. They're a little strange, but I'm pretty sure neither of them is going to try to make me uncomfortable by stripping naked. And they're from District 3. Maybe they can even confirm my suspicions of an uprising there. I glance around the training center. Peeta is at the center of a ribald circle of knife throwers. The morphlings from District 6 are in the camouflage station, painting each other's faces with bright pink swirls. The male tribute from District 5 is vomiting wine on the sword-fighting floor. Finnick and the old woman from his district are using the archery station. Joanna Mason is naked again and oiling her skin down for a wrestling lesson. I decide to stay put. Wyrus and Beatty make decent company. They seem friendly enough but don't pry. We talk about our talents. They tell me they both invent things, which makes my supposed interest in fashion seem pretty weak. Wyrus brings up some sort of stitching device she's working on. It senses the density of the fabric and selects the strength, she says, and then becomes absorbed in a bit of dry straw before she can go on. The strength of the thread, Beatty finishes explaining. Automatically, it rules out human error. Then he talks about his recent success creating a musical chip that's tiny enough to be concealed in a flake of glitter but can hold hours of songs. I remember Octavia talking about this during the wedding shoot, and I see a possible chance to allude to the uprising. Oh, yeah. My prep team was all upset a few months ago, I think, because they couldn't get hold of that, I say casually. I guess a lot of orders from District 3 were getting backed up. Beatty examines me under his glasses. Yes. Did you have any similar backups in coal production this year? He asks. No. Well, we lost a couple of weeks when they brought in a new head peacekeeper and his crew, but nothing major, I say. To production, I mean. 2 weeks sitting around your house doing nothing just means 2 weeks of being hungry for most people. I think they understand what I'm trying to say, that we've had no uprising. Oh, that's a shame, says Wyrus in a slightly disappointed voice. I found your district very... She trails off, distracted by something in her head. Interesting, fills in Beatty. We both did. I feel bad, knowing that their district must have suffered much worse than ours. I feel I have to defend my people. Well, there aren't very many of us in 12, I say. Not that you'd know it nowadays by the size of the peacekeeping force, but I guess we're interesting enough. As we move over to the shelter station, Wyrus stops and gazes up at the stands where the game makers are roaming around, eating and drinking, sometimes taking notice of us. Look, she says, giving her head a slight nod in their direction. I look up and see Plutarch Heavensby in the magnificent purple robe with the fur-trimmed collar that designates him as head game maker. He's eating a turkey leg. I don't see why this merits comment, but I say, yes, he's been promoted to head game maker this year.
No, no. There, by the corner of the table. You can just...
says Wyrus. Beatty squints under his glasses.
Just make it out.
I stare in that direction, perplexed. But then I see it. A patch of space about 6 inches square at the corner of the table seems almost to be vibrating. It's as if the air is rippling in tiny, visible waves, distorting the sharp edges of the wood and a goblet of wine someone has set there.
A force field. They've set one up between the game makers and us. I wonder what brought that on,
Beatty says. Me, probably, I confess. Last year I shot an arrow at them during my private training session. Beatty and Wyrus look at me curiously. I was provoked. So, do all force fields have a spot like that?
Chink,
says Wyrus vaguely. In the armor, as it were, finishes Beatty. Ideally, it'd be invisible, wouldn't it? I want to ask them more, but lunch is announced. I look for Peter, but he's hanging with a group of about 10 other victors, so I decide just to eat with District 3. Maybe I can get Cedar to join us. When we make our way into the dining area, I see some of Peter's gang have other ideas. They're dragging all the smaller tables to form one large table so that we all have to eat together. Now I don't know what to do. Even at school, I used to avoid eating at a crowded table. Frankly, I'd probably have sat alone if Madge hadn't made it a habit of joining me. I guess I'd have eaten with Gail, except being 2 grades apart, our lunch never fell at the same time. I take a tray and start making my way around the food-laden carts that ring the room. Peter catches up with me at the stew.
How's it going?
Good. Fine. I like the District 3 victors, I say. Wyrus and Beatty.
Really?
He asks.
There's something of a joke to the others.
Why does that not surprise me? I say.
I think of how Peter was always surrounded at school by a crowd of friends. It's amazing, really, that he ever took any notice of me except to think I was odd.
Joanna's nicknamed them Nuts and Volts, he says. I think she's nuts and he's volts.
And so I'm stupid for thinking they might be useful because of something Joanna Mason said while she was oiling up her breasts for wrestling, I retort.
Actually, I think the nickname's been around for years, and I didn't mean that as an insult. I'm just sharing information, he says.
Well, Wyrus and Beatty are smart. They invent things. They could tell by sight that a force field had been put up between us and the game makers, and if we have to have allies, I want them.
I toss the ladle back in a pot of stew, splattering us both with gravy.
What are you so angry about? Peter asks, wiping the gravy from his shirt front.
Because I teased you on the elevator?
I'm sorry. I thought you would just laugh about it.
Forget it, I say with a shake of my head. It's a lot of things.
Darius, he says.
Darius, the games, Haymitch making us team up with the others, I say.
It can just be you and me, you know, he says.
I know, but maybe Haymitch is right, I say.
Don't tell him I said so, but he usually is where the games are concerned. Well, you can have final say about our allies, but right now, I'm leaning toward Chaff and Cedar, says Peeta.
I'm okay with Cedar, not Chaff, I say.
Not yet, anyway. Come on and eat with him. I promise I won't let him kiss you again, says Peeta.
Chaff doesn't seem as bad at lunch. He's sober, and while he talks too loud and makes bad jokes a lot, most of them are at his own expense. I can see why he would be good for Haymitch, whose thoughts run so darkly. But I'm still not sure I'm ready to team up with him. I try hard to be more sociable, not just with Chaff, but with the group at large. After lunch, I do the edible insect station with the District 8 tributes. Cecilia, who's got 3 kids at home, and Woof, a really old guy who's hard of hearing and doesn't seem to know what's going on since he keeps trying to stuff poisonous bugs in his mouth. I wish I could mention meeting Twill and Bonnie in the woods, but I can't figure out how. Cashmere and Gloss, the sister and brother from District 1, invite me over, and we make hammocks for a while. They're polite but cool, and I spend the whole time thinking about how I killed both the tributes from their district, Glimmer and Marvel, last year, and that they probably knew them and might even have been their mentors. Both my hammock and my attempt to connect with them are mediocre at best. I join Inobaria at sword training and exchange a few comments, but it's clear neither of us wants to team up. Finnick appears again when I'm picking up fishing tips, but mostly just to introduce me to Mags, the elderly woman who's also from District 4. Between her district accent and her garbled speech, possibly she had a stroke. I can't make out more than 1 in 4 words, but I swear she can make a decent fish hook out of anything. A thorn, a wishbone, an earring. After a while, I tune out the trainer and simply try to copy whatever Mags does. When I make a pretty good hook out of a bent nail and fasten it to some strands of my hair, she gives me a toothless smile and an unintelligible comment I think might be praise. Suddenly, I remember how she volunteered to replace the young hysterical woman in her district. It couldn't be because she thought she had any chance of winning. She did it to save the girl, just like I volunteered last year to save Prim, and I decide I want her on my team. Great. Now I have to go back and tell Haymitch I want an 80-year-old and Nuts and Volts for my allies. He'll love that. So I give up trying to make friends and go over to the archery range for some sanity. It's wonderful there, getting to try out all the different bows and arrows.
The trainer, Tax, seeing that the standing targets offer no challenge for me, begins to launch these silly fake birds high into the air for me to hit. At first it seems stupid, but it turns out to be kind of fun. Much more like hunting a moving creature. Since I'm hitting everything he throws up, he starts increasing the number of birds he sends airborne. I forget the rest of the gym and the victors and how miserable I am and lose myself in the shooting. When I manage to take down 5 birds in 1 round, I realize it's so quiet I can hear each one hit the floor. I turn and see the majority of the victors have stopped to watch me. Their faces show everything from envy to hatred to admiration. After training, Peter and I hang out, waiting for Haymitch and Effie to show up for dinner. When we're called to eat, Haymitch pounces on me immediately. "So at least half the victors have instructed their mentors to request you as an ally. I know it can't be your sunny personality." "They saw her shoot," says Peter with a smile. "Actually, I saw her shoot, for real, for the first time. I'm about to put in a formal request myself."
"You're that good?" Haymitch asks me. "So good that Brutus wants you?"
I shrug. "But I don't want Brutus. I want Mags and District 3.
"Of course you do,"
Haymitch sighs and orders a bottle of wine. "I'll tell everybody you're still making up your mind." After my shooting exhibition, I still get teased some, but I no longer feel like I'm being mocked. In fact, I feel as if I've somehow been initiated into the victor's circle. During the next 2 days, I spend time with almost everybody headed for the arena. Even the morphlings, who, with Peeta's help, paint me into a field of yellow flowers. Even Finnick, who gives me an hour of trident lessons in exchange for an hour of archery instruction. And the more I come to know these people, the worse it is. Because on the whole, I don't hate them, and some I like. And a lot of them are so damaged that my natural instinct would be to protect them. But all of them must die if I am to save Peter. The final day of training ends with our private sessions. We each get 15 minutes before the game makers to amaze them with our skills, but I don't know what any of us might have to show them. There's a lot of kidding about it at lunch, what we might do, sing, dance, strip, tell jokes. Mags, who I can understand a little better now, decides she's going to take a nap. I don't know what I'm going to do. Shoot some arrows, I guess. Haymitch said to surprise them if we could, but I'm fresh out of ideas. As the girl from 12, I'm scheduled to go last. The dining room gets quieter and quieter as the tributes file out to go perform. It's easier to keep up the irreverent, invincible manner we've all adopted when there are more of us. As people disappear through the door, all I can think is that they have a matter of days to live. Peter and I are finally left alone. He reaches across the table and takes my hands. "Decided what to do for the game makers yet?" I shake my head. "I can't really use them for target practice this year, with the force field up and all. Maybe make some fish hooks. What about you?"
"Not a clue.
I keep wishing I could bake a cake or something," he says. "Do some more camouflage," I suggest.
"If the morphlings have left me anything to work with," he says wryly, "they've been glued to that station since training started."
We sit in silence a while, and then I blurt out the thing that's on both our minds. "How are we going to kill these people, Peter?"
"I don't know."
He leans his forehead down on our entwined hands. "I don't want them as allies. Why did Haymitch want us to get to know them?" I say. "It'll make it so much harder than last time, except for Rue, maybe. But I guess I never really could have killed her anyway. She was just too much like Prim." Peter looks up at me, his brow creased in thought. Her death was the most despicable, wasn't it? None of them were very pretty, I say, thinking of Glimmer's and Cato's ends. They call Peter, so I wait by myself. 15 minutes pass, then half an hour. It's close to 40 minutes before I'm called. When I go in, I smell the sharp odor of cleaner and notice that one of the mats has been dragged to the center of the room. The mood is very different from last year's, when the game makers were half drunk and distractedly picking at tidbits from the banquet table. They whisper among themselves, looking somewhat annoyed. What did Peter do? Something to upset them. I feel a pang of worry. That isn't good. I don't want Peter singling himself out as a target for the game maker's anger. That's part of my job, to draw fire away from Peter. But how did he upset them? Because I'd love to do just that and more, to break through the smug veneer of those who use their brains to find amusing ways to kill us, to make them realize that while we're vulnerable to the capital's cruelties, they are as well. Do you have any idea how much I hate you, I think? You, who have given your talents to the games? I try to catch Plutarch Heavensby's eye, but he seems to be intentionally ignoring me, as he has the entire training period. I remember how he sought me out for a dance, how pleased he was to show me the Mockingjay on his watch. His friendly manner has no place here. How could it, when I'm a mere tribute and he's the head game maker, so powerful, so removed, so safe? Suddenly I know just what I'm going to do. Something that will blow anything Peter did right out of the water. I go over to the knot-tying station and get a length of rope. I start to manipulate it, but it's hard because I've never made this actual knot myself. I've only watched Finnick's clever fingers, and they moved so fast. After about 10 minutes, I've come up with a respectable noose. I drag one of the target dummies out into the middle of the room, and using some chinning bars, hang it so it dangles by the neck. Tying its hands behind its back would be a nice touch, but I think it might be running out of time. I hurry over to the camouflage station, where some of the other tributes, undoubtedly the morphlings, have made a colossal mess. But I find a partial container of blood-red berry juice that will serve my needs. The flesh-colored fabric of the dummy's skin makes a good, absorbent canvas. I carefully finger-paint the words on its body, concealing them from view. Then I step away quickly to watch the reaction of the game makers' faces as they read the name on the dummy. Seneca Crane. Chapter 17. The effect on the game makers is immediate and satisfying. Several let out small shrieks. Others lose their grips on their wine glasses, which shatter musically against the ground. Two seem to be considering fainting. The look of shock is unanimous. Now I have Plutarch Heavensby's attention. He stares steadily at me as the juice from the peach he crushed in his hand runs through his fingers. Finally, he clears his throat and says, "You may go now, Miss Everdeen." I give a respectful nod and turn to go. But at the last moment, I can't resist tossing the container of berry juice over my shoulder. I can hear the contents splatter against the dummy while a couple more wine glasses break. As the elevator doors close before me, I see no one has moved. That surprised them, I think. It was rash and dangerous, and no doubt I will pay for it 10 times over, but for the moment, I feel something close to elation, and I let myself savor it. I want to find Haymitch immediately and tell him about my session,
but no one's around. I guess they're getting ready for dinner, and I decide to go take a shower myself, since my hands are stained from the juice. As I stand in the water, I begin to wonder about the wisdom of my latest trick. The question that should now always be my guide.